It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies.
Welcome back. It is a good day to talk to Ben Young. I am your host, Duncan. Joining me, as always, is Gardner.
Welcome back, folks. Happy to have you here on this Friday episode.
Yes, sir. We are here for our full-length Friday episode where, like I said, we will be talking to filmmaker Ben Young, who is known for writing and directing the feature film Hounds of Love, as well as directing the Netflix film Extinction, which you can watch now because they don't take their own originals off of Netflix. They just keep them streaming there, so you can always watch it there. As of now, actually, maybe they'll one day fuck us all over. Who knows? He's also known for many other things. He's directed two episodes of the show Clickbait, also on Netflix, as well as an episode of The Wilds. But he'll tell you more about that in this great interview that we have lined up for you today. As we've said, today is your full-length Friday episode, where here on GDT, we have our interviews, often with independent filmmakers or other people associated with the filmmaking industry. We also here on GDT have other bonus episodes releasing weekly. On Tuesdays, we have our MPU, Marvel Podcasting Universe, episodes where CB, Mac, Jalen, myself, and sometimes Gardner, as well as other guests, stop by weekly to go through the MCU movie by movie. This week we dropped Iron Man 3, and we've previously covered all of the movies before that in the MCU, and we'll continue to do the films that come afterwards until we get to the end or present day. Obviously, on top of that, we've told you before that we also do relevant TV shows and movies that are superhero related on those episodes. So Marvel, Disney, independent, anything will be discussed on those Tuesday episodes whenever there's a new movie or TV show. So Thor 4 just dropped, and we'll be discussing that next Tuesday, and then we'll be discussing the season finale of The Boys on our Thursday episode next week. Usually our Thursday episodes are a new TV show, a new movie, something relevant, or we have sometimes a guest on to talk about one of their favorite films. But next week we decided to kind of mix together our MPU and our regular bonus episodes in a mixture on the Tuesday episode where we will be recapping the entire season 3 of The Boys. So yeah, Tuesday episodes where we go through the MCU and other superhero episodes. Thursday bonus episodes where we go through something relevant. Could be superhero related like next week, or it could be something else. And then you have our full-length Friday episodes where we have our interviews with independent filmmakers and other people involved in the filmmaking process. We've told you a couple times already, but you should be excited. Today, we are talking to the very talented Ben Young, another Australian guest today, and someone who is not only making films that I'm super into. We'll get into whether Extinction is another Duncan film, which if you've listened to this podcast, you know what I'm talking about there, but you can hear about that in the interview, but also someone who is on the precipice of some really, really exciting things. His career is going in an awesome direction, and we cannot wait to see what he brings next. And let's just say he talks about some upcoming projects as well as his past work and where he's at now. Gives us a bunch of good stuff in this interview. We really can't wait to share it with you. Before we do that, though, Extinction is a movie that you definitely want to avoid spoilers for, definitely surrounding the plot, for example. So if you are planning on listening to this interview, I would definitely recommend having watched Extinction prior to listening, because there are some things that are revealed in this interview that you definitely, in my opinion, do not want to know on your first watch. So here is your big, loud spoiler warning for Extinction for sure in this interview. I don't think we got into the nitty-gritty details of the spoilers of Hounds of Love, but we do talk about what it's generally about, but nothing too crazy. If you haven't seen Hounds of Love, I would still recommend watching that before listening to this, because I think it adds a lot to it. But to be fair, if you want to listen first and then get yourself excited about watching Hounds of Love, to each their own, you can try that as well. But big, loud spoiler warning, if you have not seen Extinction, don't listen to this interview. First watch it, then listen to this interview, because it's great. We have Ben Young here to spoil Extinction. So if you haven't seen it, turn this off now, get back to us later. And for everyone else, that was your spoiler warning. So I don't know what else I can tell you about this interview that Ben isn't going to tell you during it in much better words, articulated way better than me. He'll tell you all the good details that you want to know about his filmmaking process, about his career, what's coming up next, everything. So without further ado, here it is, our interview with Ben Young.
We are joined now by a very special guest, Ben Young, the filmmaker known for writing and directing Hounds of Love, directing Extinction, which is available to watch on Netflix, and other films, is here with us today to talk about his career. Ben, thank you for joining us today.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
We're super excited to get into your whole career. But before we do that, I want to know, that was a very brief background. Is there anything you want to add to that to let our audience know about? I mean, you've done more than just those two films that I mentioned, obviously.
Yeah, I did a couple of episodes of the Netflix show Clickbait. I did episodes 5 and 6 of that. And I just did a show called The Wilds for Amazon. I did the season finale of the second season of that, which was fun. And I'm in post-production now for a movie that I shot in Atlanta at the end of last year called Where All Light Tends to Go, based on a book by a North Carolina writer called David Joy. And I'm currently, just for fun, I'm doing second unit on a movie called Kid Snow, which is shooting in my hometown of Perth, Western Australia, which is why I agreed to do that one.
All right, awesome. So we'll definitely be asking a couple follow-up questions to some of the things you mentioned there, see if we can't get a couple teases later on in the interview. But before we do that, we obviously have now mentioned where you can find some of the episodes that you've directed, for example. I would recommend watching the entire series up to those episodes so you know what's going on in the series before you just hop right into like a season finale, for example.
Yeah.
But check those out. But what about your films? Is there a place that people can find them? Can you tell our audience where they can find your films?
Yeah, Extinction is easy to find because that's just on Netflix. But Hounds of Love is a little harder to find because I don't think it's on any of the streamers. It's on all the pay-per-views. And so I know you can get it on Hulu, iTunes, YouTube Pay, all of the pay ones, unfortunately. I don't know what's going on with that, but for whatever reason, it hasn't ended up on any of the regular streamers, which is a little frustrating for me.
Speaking of Hounds of Love, what was that process like getting that film made? What was your filmmaking career looking like up until that point, and how did you get started on working on your feature?
Oh, that's quite a funny question, really. So my background is kids television. I directed like 3 kids series back to back, and I was also doing tons of music videos and television commercials and stuff. And I wrote a short film, which was a musical comedy, and I applied for funding for it in Western Australia, and I didn't get it. But one of the people on the panel, producer Melissa Kelly, she liked it so much, she came up to me afterwards and said, "Dude, have you got something which is kind of like this, but a feature film? Because I want to make a movie which is sort of like this." I went, "Sure." And I sent her the script for Hounds of Love, which is anything but a musical romantic comedy. And so we got that cracking from there. So that's really how it begun. But, you know, the backstory on that is Hounds of Love was the 11th feature film script that I wrote. That's how long it takes. And I got really close with a couple of other ones. One of them I even got financed, and they all just fell over at the last minute. So Hounds of Love was sort of my last hurrah. I'd had so much misfortune with getting movies made that I was like, all right, well, this one's got some traction now. If this one doesn't get into production, I don't know if anything I ever write will. And so, I'm glad it did, because I may have moved into a different career if it hadn't.
Yeah, your 11th script being the one that got made.
And multiple drafts of them. Like, they weren't just like sit at home and write 100 pages over the weekend. Some of these scripts were 10 years in development. Usually have more than one on the go at once, but they all had producers. They all, you know, were doing the rounds at distributors and the whatnot. So they weren't just weekend warrior 90-page documents. They were well-developed screenplays, all 11 of them. And so it was, a tough break.
Now that you're at a different stage in your career, would you ever consider going back to any of those scripts?
Yeah, I got a couple of them, like at least 2 of them, I think, shit hot. But it's not just as easy as going back to them now. Like, one of the ones that I think is really good was intended to be my first film. And so it's tiny, you know, it's a really, really little movie. It's even smaller than Hounds of Love. And so it's not a good career move for me to make that now, you know, because you don't really want to be seen as going backwards in terms of the budgets that you're working with. And the other one I really love, but I keep getting told by the people representing me and stuff, but it's just so fucking dark that they don't want me to make it because they think that it's just going to make people hate me. And I'm like, oh, come to love. There's no Disney movie. And so, yeah. But anyway, both of those scripts, one of them I'd really love to make. One of them I wouldn't for the reasons I outlined, but I've kind of given both of them or let other filmmakers who are kind of looking for their first movie, I let them read them. And I've got a couple circling around and you know, they might go ahead and do them. Otherwise, maybe one day I'll just get fed up of reading crap, which is mostly what I get sent, and go back and do one of those. But I've got a few active other screenplays in development, which I have written since Hounds of Love, which are more sort of at the level that I need to be playing at if I'm going to stay relevant or have any kind of relevance.
And speaking of your writing process, you've kind of touched on some of these, like you mentioned that you do work on more than one screenplay at a time, which was something that we were definitely going to ask. But can you delve into what that writing process does look like a little bit?
Yeah.
Because you mentioned that some of them, it takes years of writing to get to kind of a finished product. Is that usual for you? Is it a long process when you're writing something, or do you kind of vary? Like, do you kind of bang some of them out? Like, inspiration just hits and it's like very quickly written.
Yeah, if it's a spec and I know that I only have limited time before I got to go off and do something else, I can write a screenplay in as quick as 2 or 3 weeks. But I call that a vomit draft that I just kind of stick. I go, oh, cool. I got a cool idea for something. I'm just going to get this out. So I've just got that document sitting on my laptop. And then, you know, later on when I have more time, I can go back and visit those. And so, yeah, so that can be the case. But usually if it's a job, if it's a proper screenplay job, you get more time than that. It's normally about a 3-month turnaround because you can't have spelling mistakes in a document that someone's paying you to write or anything like that. So that's a much more kind of finessed process. And yeah, that takes longer. And I start, tell me if I'm rabbiting on too much, but it's different every time. But I have a document which is permanently open on my laptop called Movie Ideas. And I just email myself if I have an idea for a character or just a one-liner, like, what if this happened? I email myself. I've got like 500 little one-line premises. And so then if I decide that I've got time to write a spec, I'll probably just go through that and see if any of them resonate. And go, okay, cool. So it's this one. So what's this really about? And then I'll come up with a thesis statement for it. Because I kind of look at every good movie is sort of a fictitious essay. So, you know, all that time that I was doing English class in high school ended up kind of being more valuable than I thought it was at the time, because the movie should have an argument and it should have a thesis. And so then I kind of look at it as a fictitious essay. It's like, all right, well, what's my thesis? And am I going to argue for it or against it? Okay, cool. I've decided that. Now, who are the people who are involved in this? And then I kind of write anywhere from half a page to a page on who I think the players are, you know, the who, what, when, why. That's all really important. Nothing more so than the who. And then I break it down into 8 key points. And I think most movies have about 8 sequences. So I try and just come up with what the culmination of each one of them is and how that might spin the character into the next one. And so once I come up with those 8 points, once I come up with those characters, I come up with those 8 main key plot points, and then I flesh that out into an outline. And then I start writing a screenplay. So the screenplay I kind of put off for as long as possible. And it's boring because all of the stuff at the beginning is the boring shit. Writing a screenplay is the fun part. But unfortunately, I very rarely read a good screenplay that someone told me they just bashed out. Most of the experienced and the stronger writers I know plan all of this. And so one day I decided to kind of start planning, and sure enough, started having more success when I did.
And as a writer, do you find yourself drawn to any particular kind of subject matter or genre, or do you like to kind of explore and go all these different routes? Because you mentioned earlier about not wanting to go back and do that smaller film because of where you are in your career. Are there things you won't touch? Are there areas that you want to go to in the future? What does that kind of look like for you?
It's a really good question. And I'm not opposed to small movies at all. Like, I love small movies, but they've got to have a big enough thesis or a big enough, you know, an interesting enough character that is going to draw in a movie star. The other one that I was talking about is so sort of small, and it's not really talking about anything that the world hasn't heard before, or, you know, it's not a truly original movie. And so it'll stay a small movie, you know, so you can have a small movie with a big idea. And my one is just a small idea with a small idea. So I really am drawn to small movies with big ideas. And no, I don't think there's much I won't touch, you know, like I'm in development right now for a Western, a shark movie and a sci-fi movie and a horror movie. So there are four active scripts that I'm working on right now with various different people around the world. And so, yeah, I guess when I started my career, a lot of my short stuff was comedy. Most of my music videos were comedy, but I have never had that funny idea that I wanted to write. My first ever screenplay was a rom-com. There you go. But since then, I've never really been drawn to that. I just want to make stuff that somehow makes an audience member feel something, whatever that is. You know, it could be elation, it could be horror, it could be terror. And yeah, and I just haven't had an idea that I think will make someone feel joy yet.
So we've been talking about your writing style a lot, and obviously you wear more than just that hat when it comes to filmmaking. How would you describe your directing style? I want to say, for example, you have gotten some really good performances out of your actors. So
thank you.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm sure that has to do a lot with not only having a good cast, obviously, and valuable team members, but your directing is part of what gets those performances out. So I'm curious as to how you approach that.
Yeah, so I'm not a very technical filmmaker. Some people might tell you otherwise, but I think my directing style is really loose and really, really collaborative. I don't really get married to any ideas. I come up with a plan that I really want to do, and then I just talk to people. I talk to the DP, I talk to the cast, I talk to the designer, and I kind of let them take my idea wherever they want, and usually they make it a lot better. So yeah, I'm totally collaborative. I'm not one of those dudes who comes onto set. It's like, all right, it's got to be this way. Don't give line reads or anything like that. And as far as talking to actors goes, I just try and give them as good an idea on who the character is and what they want out of the scene, more importantly. And then I just say, go for it. And I do more and more, TV's different, but in my films, I'm doing more and more improvisation. So the one that I just did in Georgia, I'd always do like a couple of takes, I'd give the actors notes, and then I'd say, well, what do you want to do? Like, is there anything you want to do in this scene? And sometimes they just go, yeah. And I go, well, give me one for the four, take a risk. It doesn't matter if it sucks, because I've got what I want out of the scene. Just do one, just take a risk, and maybe we'll come up with gold. And so, yeah, I give the actors a lot of freedom in that sense. And a lot of them really dig that as well. So, yeah, I think the briefest way to sum up how I direct is I try and empower everybody that I'm working with and make them feel like they are an important part of this movie and they're not just there to service my vision. They're there to collaborate with me and come up with a vision that we all agree with, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I just want to expound upon that a little bit and ask you about the pre-production process.
Yeah.
Then, because that tends to be a lot of very meticulous planning.
Yeah.
Right. So what is your main focus on in the pre-production stage? Characters, environment, set design, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
What does that look like? Because if you are leaning towards being more improvisational during the day of filming.
Are you guys filmmakers?
We dabble.
Aspiring, maybe.
All right, yeah. You're asking very good questions. That's why I asked.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so look, I meticulously plan. I block everything and I go there. And so when I say improvisation, I don't mean improvising an entire scene. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, it might be, so you know, you have to go in there as a director. And if you don't know what you're doing, everybody's going to know it.
Right.
And so you walk in there and you go, okay, you grab your script with the actors and you go, all right, let me just hear the lines. You know, this is on the spot. And then the actors will say the lines and they'll go, okay, are any of those bumping you? You know, and then one of them might go, you know, I don't feel like I'd say this. I feel like I might say this. And then I'll go, well, yeah, that's great. Let's do that. Or let's not, because. And so then you kind of figure out, okay, this is what everybody's going to say. So that's not really improvisation. And then I'll go, okay, the scene is going to start. I want it to start with you walking into the bedroom and you're going to find you already sat on the bed. And I don't think you should sit on the bed until this point in the scene, because that is the moment where she actually makes you feel sorry for her. So don't sit, just stand at the door like you could leave at any minute until that moment. And then when he sits at this moment, you get up and you exit. That, I think, is the shape. And then the actors will go, okay, cool, let's try that. And then they'll do it and it will work. Or they'll go, you know what? Like, Ben, rather than sit on that line, can I sit on this line? And I'll go, yeah, you know, I think that'll work. And then she might say, I think it's more powerful if I don't leave. It's more powerful if I just like roll over and turn away from him. And I'll go, you know what? I think you're right. Or I'll say, no, she's got to leave for X, Y, and Z. So you figure all of that out in the block before. And when I'm blocking, I allow the DP to be in the room and I allow the first AD to be in the room. I don't allow anybody else. And so, you know, then my plan that I've done in pre-production to do with the blocking has just changed a little bit because now she's not going to come out. She's going to just, or she is, or whatever, you know, they're going to move around a little bit. And then I go, okay, well, let's do it now. And then, so I'll do it and then we'll see it and we'll go, great. So basically this scene is two parts. We've got the part where he is by the door and we've got the part where she is over there. Let's just concentrate on the part of the door. Let's get all the coverage we need for that and let's do the second part later. And then when we're doing the second part, that might be the more important bit. And there might be a scene there where he is confessing to her. And that's just one shot. You know, he's already sat on the bed by that point. So go, let's just pick it up from when you sat at the bed and just give me that part of the scene three times and I'm not going to cut. So you call that series takes where the actor just does it. And you go, again, just different choice. You don't cut. And then they do it again and again. And then I'll just say, all right, now you know the intention. I think I've got it. It's beautiful. Now do that in your own words, you know? And so then they'll do an improvisation, but they're not improvising the whole scene. Do you know what I mean? Like, so the blocking work that I've done is still relevant and still means that I can cut this because of continuity, but I'm just giving them that little moment to improvise.
Yeah, it sounds like you're able to give them the freedom to improvise because you've built a tight framework.
Yeah. 100%, 100%. That's right. Because, you know, there's this great misconception about improvising because if I just get the actors and I go, all right, so come into this room and just do the scene, just go crazy. Well, they're going to do it. They're going to do it fucking crazy. And it's never going to be the same way twice. They're never going to be in the same spot twice. And I'm going to have this messy thing that will not cut together. And so you have to kind of break it down into those little parts and give them some kind of parameters because otherwise, you know, it's just not going to work. It's just going to be impossible to cut. So, you know, I let them improvise within reason. And then as far as other pre-production goes, well, you can't do a lot until you've got your locations, you know, like you can't start drawing out your overtop mud maps until you've actually seen what the shape of the room looks like for all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you have to start with the locations department. So that's where you begin. So I use a very simple app called Canva. And I just basically, I go in there and I build a photo board for the entire movie. And I start with characters. And so I just do like a mood board for what every character looks like. And I come up with a palette, you know, it's like this character represents spring. And so let's give her, you know, pastel colors and greens and pinks and baby blues and all of this, whereas this guy represents fall. And so everything that he's wearing should be kind of faded and this and that and the other, and, you know, and so it goes on. And so then you've got, you know, your three kind of, or four or however many different color palettes for different people. I often, you know, a lot of my movies, well, at least two of them deal with gender politics. And so I create different worlds. I go, all right, well, this is the man's world. And so we're going to use hot colors, you know, like fire. And this is the woman's world. So we're going to use like a cooler palette. So I kind of come up with the palette for the movie before I do much else. And then, you know, once you got that, then you can present that palette to your locations department and your production designer, and then they can start building the rest of the world with it. And then once you start finding locations, that's when you can start working with the DP to figure out, well, how's visually this thing going to look? And of course, you know, it sounds like such a simple thing, but it also doesn't hurt to, you know, just have a collection of other movies that you sort of want this to be like, you know? And so that's what you do with your DP. I just talk to them about, have you seen this? Well, if you haven't, let's watch it together. And let's talk about like why they use these lenses or whatnot, you know? And I try and come up with like a lens rule as well, you know, like maybe the movie is going to start. I'm never going to shoot it like longer than like a 40 mil lens because there's no tension in the world. But then as the tension builds up, I'm going to shoot it longer and longer and longer lenses because I know that that's going to compress the world around the character and make them feel more boxed in. And so that's going to add to the tension. And then at this point in the movie, the tension breaks. I'm going to go back to using, you know, 40 mils or wider. And so, you know, I try and come up with broad brushstroke rules that, you know, you can apply to everything, because then once you've got those rules, like nothing in the first act is going to be off the shoulder, you know, everything in the first act is going to be studio set up. So once you've got that, then you can start improvising and changing stuff around, but you just stick to those parameters. And so even if I'm messing with the scene, the DP goes, all right, well, this is only scene six. This is in the first act. The first act style guide says that everything is studio, you know, so we're all in dollies or we're all here or we're all there. So yeah, long-winded answer, but I hope that kind of touched on what is a very long process.
No, definitely. I feel like there's negative connotations to long-winded, and that was an in-depth answer that I think gives us a lot of insight. Things that people maybe not always think about when they think, you know, writing, directing, are things that I think editing even, maybe to a certain degree, that, you know, the average moviegoer is aware of, and they might not think about what goes into writing and directing and all the other aspects as well. But specifically right now, that answer was great for people who don't really understand what goes into directing a movie and setting up, you know, just one scene, for example, and like how much goes into the smallest things in films. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's just, it's amazing how often, you know, I find on set, we're just like held up by something that no audience member is probably even going to notice. You know, like when I was doing Extinction, I think it was one of the first shots we had to do. Erica Tremblay, who plays the little girl, all she had to do was walk under a Christmas tree and unwrap a present. But the fucking Christmas paper that the art department had used was unrippable because they decided that it was going to be easier for them to reset if they could just like wrap it back up and put the bow on. I'm going, dude, the script says she rips it open. Like, I got a fiver, she can't open it, you know? And so then we lost like 45 minutes while we had to get new paper on the set that you could actually tear open, you know? It's like, wow.
Yeah, again, the small things is really interesting. And I love that story too. I love getting those like insight into movies that I love too. So little behind the scenes stuff is great. You mentioned though in that, again, very in-depth answer, that part of it that helps when you're thinking of like the mood boards, for example, and knowing like color palettes for a character, you also mentioned that having like films that you have in mind that you want, not necessarily that you're referencing them, for example, but to certain degrees that they're inspiring you. And I wanted to ask, are there any films or filmmakers that you consider your biggest inspirations when you're making a film?
Yeah, I think so. And I get more inspired by tone than anything else, because like it's everything creates tone, you know, like nothing more so than the edit, really. The color creates tone, camera approach creates tone, performance creates tone. And so I like to, you know, I rarely say, you know, watch this movie because I love the lenses they use. It'll more be like, watch this because I love the tone. And so like tonally, I'm really inspired by, obviously, it's a cliche answer, but Stanley Kubrick is like a master of tone, I think. And so is Terrence Malick. I love what he does with tone. And, you know, more contemporary, I think Steve McQueen is, again, really masters tone. So does Justin Cazale and Denis Villeneuve. Oh, and Deborah Granik. She's just tremendous at tone. All of these filmmakers, you can see that they made it, you know? Like, I think that if anyone, you know, someone put on one of their movies and I didn't know who directed it, I'd pretty quickly be able to go like, nah, this is Cazale or this is Granik. So there's some.
And you mentioned the edit being so pivotal in creating tone and obviously, you know, sculpting down the marble into the final product. How long does that take you? Obviously you're going to be very involved in that process, but I think everyone kind of has a different approach. Some people just hand the footage off to the colorist and then we come back and sculpt it. How granular do you get in that process?
I'm probably every editor's nightmare because I never leave. So from the minute it wraps, so if I wrap on a Friday, which you usually do, I'm in with the editor on the following Monday before they've even done an assembly. And I'm in there until the very end. And they all take different amounts of time. I think Hounds of Love took about 14 weeks. The one that I've just done took even longer, took about 16 weeks. Extinction probably took about the same. And every movie that I've made has been dramatically reinvented from the page in the edit. And so I think that that's where my background as a writer comes in. I scrutinize everything and I'm really big into, you know, like, okay, well, there's the script that we shot, but I think this movie can be better. Let's look at, you know, losing this character or, you know, this character here will be so much more powerful if we change this scene. So it doesn't actually mean what it was meant to. It means this. And so I do a lot of experimenting for better or worse in the edit. Like, I mean, Hounds of Love, for instance, that was financed by the Australian government. And there's a pro and a con to living in a country where the government will finance movies. The pro is, well, you don't have a studio breathing down your neck. And so you kind of get absolute creative control once you've got the movie up. But the con is because it's taxpayer money. They can get very, very conservative and political motivations seem to have a lot to do with the decisions that they're making. And I opened the screenplay of Hounds of Love with a fairly brutal murder and got told outright that we weren't going to fund this movie if I opened like that, because it's an unpalatable way to open a film. It's too much for the Australian public to see that on screen as the first scene. I was like, okay, I'll get rid of it. Just please don't take the money away from my movie. So I cut it out And then when we got into the edit, the common note that we were getting from everybody is the movie is really good 15 minutes in, but the first 15 minutes suck. And everybody was right. It just felt like a soap opera was swearing. It was like about an upper middle class girl who was a little bit sad because her parents had divorced. You know, that's what the first 15 minutes of the movie was about. And like, who gives a shit, you know? And me and the editor were like, oh my God, what this movie needs to open with is a fucking murder. Just like I'd wanted to open it with in the first place, because that would have tonally set something over all of the images and scenes that followed with the girl. It would have had a darker undertone and you would have been like, oh my God, I know what's going to happen to her. So we ended up constructing a murder from offcuts and deleted scenes. And so the movie does open with a murder, but all the close-ups you see in that, they're all of the main girl and they're all shots that have been flopped or from deleted scenes that we ended up creating that first sequence from. So yeah, so that takes time. And we only cracked that. Me and the editor came up with that idea 3 days before we were meant to pitch a lock. And so, yeah.
Damn, is all I can say. I would not have guessed that, because when watching it, I was like, okay, yeah, this makes perfect sense. This is how the movie opens. This works tonally completely to set the scene for the rest of it.
Yeah.
I love getting that behind the scenes info, because sometimes it's fascinating to know what you, when you're watching the film and what seems to be like so perfectly in place.
Yeah.
Is, you know, in a sense, improvised.
Absolutely. And it's funny though, I was on a panel on Sunday night actually talking, and I told that story. And then somebody said, do you think it would have been as good if you'd shot it? And I went, no, you know, it wouldn't have been. I probably would have shot it too like gratuitously or like not cool enough. But because our hand got forced and we had such limited bits of vision that we could use, we ended up coming up with something really subtle and really tonal that was just, you know, close-ups of blood on the floor here, close-ups of a skin with chain around it and all this kind of business. And it probably is a lot cooler now than it would have been otherwise. And I just got lucky in the sense that the other thing that I do when I direct is I tend to overshoot everything. And part of that is because I know that this movie probably isn't going to work because I've never shot one that does. So, you know, we're going to need extra stuff in post-production. So, yeah, I overshoot everything. And that allows me to do experimentation, stuff like that. Yeah.
So speaking of post-production and finishing the film,
mm-hmm.
What does distribution look like for you? Because I would imagine that distributing, for example, Hounds of Love, which like you said was financed by the Australian government, looks a lot different than, for example, selling Extinction to Netflix.
Yeah.
Which obviously is distributed by them then.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's been different every time. I'm only working on my third movie now, but it's been really different every time. So Hounds of Love, before the Australian government will invest any money in your movie, production money that is, you need to have a distributor and they need to promise X amount of screens or whatever, you know, that means. So we did. We had a little boutique indie distributor here. And then as a result of that, we were able to get a sales agent out of France, I think. And then we got into the Venice Film Festival, and then it sold to a whole bunch of territories around the world and got a pretty, for a tiny indie film, it got a pretty wide theatrical, worldwide theatrically. It was released in the US and England and in France. It made more money in opening weekend than it did an 8-week run in the cinemas in Australia. It's crazy. So, you know, so that was pretty good. But while that got a good theatrical, I've been blown away at why it isn't on any streamers. Like, it's not on Netflix. It's not on any of the Australian streamers. It's not, you know, it's only on the pay-per-view. And that's a little bit annoying. So I don't know what's going on with that. Then Extinction was actually made by Universal. And we were going to be on 1,500 screens just in the US on the release date. But then they sold it to Netflix. And so, which was kind of good for me, I think, because I think the movie would have bombed theatrically, but it did really, really well for Netflix. So that was good. So a lot of people were able to see that because, you know, Netflix is Netflix. And this new one, Where All Light Tends to Go, I'm not sure what that looks like. I'm not sure, you know, I know that Universal have worldwide rights and Screen Media are involved. And it'll all just depend, I think, on if it gets into any festival or whatever, if it gets any heat. I think that will really depend on whether it goes theatrical or it goes to VOD. And it's a difficult movie to sell. It's a lot darker than a lot. It feels like a true indie. The thing that I think it may have going for it is the fact it's movie star driven. And so, you know, we got Billy Bob Thornton and Robin Wright, and they are so, so good in it that that might be enough to get us on some big screens, I hope. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's a part that I often get left out of, or they tell me about it and it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I do want to just shout out, I know it's not the most premium site because there is some ads that you have to watch. So it's not like Netflix and all the other ones where it's ad free. But for at least our American listeners, I'm not sure where else it is available. Tubi does have Hounds of Love. You do have to watch it with ads, like I said, so there'll be some commercial breaks. So it's not the full experience, but I do want to let everyone know. I would just rent it. Like we've mentioned earlier, it is available VOD. But just in case anyone is like, oh, no streamers, you can watch it with ads in America. Just a little shout out for anyone who's looking for it.
Oh, good. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Tubi has a lot of the old movie selection as well, so it's got an interesting library. So I always like to shout it out when I can, because although it does have the ads, it's got a good selection. And sometimes streaming service, like you said, it's like, why isn't Hounds of Love anywhere? They have a weird selection nowadays. It used to be, I think, a better selection on those streaming sites when they were newer, potentially. But
yeah,
you were mentioning Extinction and its reception that it got. And I just wanted to throw out there, I guess this isn't necessarily a question, it's more of a statement, but it's something that falls into what we've mentioned on this podcast a lot. Our listeners have heard it a million times, but a Duncan movie. I'm Duncan. That's what that's referring to. And it's like so up my alley in the style of like sci-fi is a lot of times an element in it. And like a twist, for example, is a heavy aspect of a Duncan movie a lot of times. And then it's just got like a style to it too. I had like a lot of times like indier movies, like I don't know if you've seen Coherence. That's probably like the biggest example that I can throw out there of a Duncan movie. But I just like when it came out on Netflix, I think I read the description. I was like, all right, I'm gonna watch this right now, and was just blown away by it. I love the whole, I don't know, I honestly don't know how many people I've shown it to, but when it first came out, I was like, it's on Netflix, we can just watch it like right now. Like, sit on the couch and we'll throw it on. And I definitely am not surprised that it got the reception it did. And it's interesting to hear you say that you think that potentially like the Netflix release actually helped it reach an audience easier.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, thank you for saying that. You'd probably love my cut of it. My version is very, very different.
Ooh.
And I think way cooler, but you know, I got changed. I'll show you this other thing if you like nerding out. So like the way that we came up with the shadows is you start with building models. So this is the original model they made.
Oh, shit.
They made for us to, yeah, it's very cool. So yeah, they made this for approval, and then we went into making the costumes.
That's rad.
And then, and there's the clapperboard from Extinction as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Have you not wiped that off since you wrapped?
Nah. Nope, I haven't.
And I won't, I don't think. So yeah, that was the last shot.
Good man.
That was very cool. Thank you for showing us that.
No worries.
Sorry, audio listeners.
Yeah.
You're shit out of luck.
So obviously we've been talking about, like I've mentioned, the entire process of filmmaking, which you've said you're hands-on in many ways, like for example the edit, and you want to be involved in everything, and it sounds like you have a background in, or experience at least from your own films, in most aspects of the filmmaking process. When you are making a film from conception until end product, like we've talked about like the variations and how long it takes you to write, but how long would you say it takes you from the idea until like you're done, you finish the edit, usually for a film?
Hounds of Love was ridiculous, like how quick it was. I literally got that financed on a first draft that I had written in about, by the time we got it financed, I'd picked up the pen 4 months earlier, and then it wasn't good enough, but it wasn't good enough to get made, but it was good enough to be financed. And so then we spent a year developing the script and just tightening it. And then we cast it. It was probably from initial concept to final cut, that movie was about a 2-year process, which is fucking insanely quick. Like that was fast. And then Extinction, that just came on the back of Hounds of Love. So I was shooting Extinction before Hounds of Love was even released. Like Hounds played, it had the premiere on the 2nd of September in 2016. And by February 2017, I was in Serbia in pre-production for Extinction. And that was released in July of 2018. So that one was, I'd only been involved in that one for about 2 years as well. Whereas Light, I got, Where All Light Tends to Go, I got sent the script in 2016. and have been, you know, developing it with the writer, Robert Knott, since then. And, you know, for various other reasons, you know, I'd go off and do Extinction, or I'd go off and do TV, or he'd have another writing gig or something like that, or we just couldn't get an actor. That project really had big gaps where nothing was happening, to the point of where I didn't think it would get made. And it only got made because Robin Wright came on board as a producer and took it to her friend Billy Bob Thornton, and he agreed to do it. We couldn't find anybody who wanted to play that role because it's so dark. And thank God Billy did, because like he was the number one pick in the first place. We just thought he was unattainable.
And speaking of going from Hounds of Love to Extinction, it's kind of a two-pronged question, but what was like your biggest challenge going from the kind of smaller production of Hounds of Love to something bigger budget on Extinction, and also going from something that you wrote yourself? I know you said that you were working with the writer and developing it, but still to going to something that is somebody else's script?
It's another good question. So yes, so one of the biggest challenges with that is that script had been floating around Hollywood for 10 years or something ridiculous like that, and for whatever reason had fallen over and never got up. And so I was the new kid on the block. And so, you know, I was working with producers who'd been involved in this thing for 10 years and perhaps maybe were in love with ideas that I wasn't, you know? And so that was the hard thing, to come on board and basically find a way to try and take their baby off them and brutalize it. So coming in so late into the game really made it tough when it came to arguing my point, when these guys have been in love with some of these things that they've been wanting to do with this movie for nearly 10 years or so. So that was really tough. And the other really tough thing is, being a studio movie, the buck didn't stop with me, you know, like every decision that I made, I'd have to justify to the producers and then justify to the studio. And so I was constantly spending time in pre-production, having meetings, talking about explaining myself. Like, this is why I want to have the costumes this way. This is why I want the set to be this way. Like, to put it in perspective, the script for Extinction wasn't set in the future. It just read like it was now. And I was like, well, it wouldn't be like now, because like they're fucking robots. Sorry, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it. And they have been for a long time, like nearly 100 years. They wouldn't care about things like fashion. They don't have a sex drive. They don't eat. They don't do anything like this. And so the world is not going to look like the world that we live in. And so that was never in the script. So that whole world that was in the first half was something that I had to design and something that I had to pitch and something that I had to argue for. So that was tough. That was really challenging, having to deal with, yeah, so many other people who could stop me. Whereas, you know, on an indie film, the director has a lot more power, unless it comes down to money. Like, the only reason a producer is ever really going to tell you no on an indie is because you can't afford to do it. That's it. But creatively, if you can afford to do it, they're not going to stop you. So, you know, they really let you do what you want. And, you know, the other hard thing about Serbia was I didn't speak the language. So I'm in this country where I don't even speak the language, trying to direct a movie which was literally more than 10 times the budget of my first one. And I didn't know a soul. You know, I didn't know anybody, you know, whereas Hounds of Love, I shot with the DP who shot all of my best music videos. I'd done a dozen commercials with someone I knew really well. And because I shot it in Perth, I even knew all the grips. I knew the lighting guy is my best friend, still is, you know, the gaffer on that film. So I knew everybody. And then I go to a country where I don't speak the language and I don't know a soul. And so that made it tough as well. Whereas, you know, on Light, I didn't want to be in that position again. So thankfully, over the years, I got to know the writer really well. So that was really good. My manager, Josh Kesselman, was also a producer on it. So that was really good. But I brought the DP from Hounds of Love from Australia. I brought him over to Atlanta and he shot it, which was great. I brought Emma Booth, who is the lead actress in Hounds of Love, one of them. I brought her over to play a part in it. I brought Harrison Gilbertson, who plays the boyfriend in Hounds of Love. He plays a part in it as well. And then I brought all of the post-production to Western Australia. So I'm doing all the editing here with the same editor of Hounds of Love, all the VFX with the same VFX company of Hounds of Love. You know, so with this one, I was able to surround myself more with my peeps.
And you've obviously given us a lot of insight into what you're working on next. And you've mentioned that you're working on a lot of this, you know, it's not just the one film, but, and I do want to thank you for your time, and we're getting to the wrap up questions. I do promise.
No worries.
I did want to ask if, I know you've already teased a lot, but you know, you've said Robin Wright and Billy Bob Thornton are in this new one, or one of the new ones. Do you want to, for our audience, like tease anything else about that or any of the other films, timeline wise, or even like if you have like any like teasers for the plot? Like, obviously no spoilers, I'm not asking you.
Yep.
for anything like that, but...
No, yeah. Like, so it's based on a book called Where All Light Tends to Go. So the book plot is very available. So, you know, so it's none of it is a secret. It's an indie, small film, but it's basically, it's about a young kid growing up in the Appalachian Mountains whose dad is a massive meth dealer in the hood. And the dad is wanting him to take over the family meth business, but he's got other ideas. So he decides to set about a plan to rip his dad off and run away with his high school sweetheart. And the son is played by Hopper Penn, who's Robin Wright's real life son. So that's kind of cool having her playing his mum. The girlfriend is played by Caitlin Nacon, who you may remember from The Walking Dead. And Jackie Earle Haley, wonderful actor, got nominated for an Oscar for his part in Little Children. He's an investigating cop in the film. And so that's it. It's a through and through crime thriller, you know, like it's not quite as dark as Hounds of Love, but it's really violent, really funny. And I'd call it a crime drama / crime thriller. And tonally, it's very much in the world of Hounds of Love, except I think a lot more commercially accessible.
And you also mentioned that you brought in a lot of your Aussie family.
Yep.
To work on this. Is that something that's important to you, is to kind of uplift the Aussie filmmaking community?
Totally. I even brought in an Australian producer in the end. And so that's how I was able to do, he raises more money because we ran out of money. And Jamie Hilton is his name. And he lives in Perth where I live as well. And I brought him on board and he was able to raise us more money and kind of take care of all the Perth stuff. And again, this is someone I knew and or know and someone I trust. And so it's hugely important. So yeah, this, as far as I know, is the first US movie to do all of its post-production in Western Australia. And there is a reason for that. I don't want to have to bring my peeps over there. I want to start bringing my American peeps over here. And so I've got a movie that I'm hoping to do at the end of next year called The Quiet, which I won't give much away from, but that I want to bring, that's a US-Australian co-production. And I want to set that in Western Australia. So my next experiment is to try and bring over all the Americans that I need to Western Australia and, you know, shoot Perth for San Francisco or California or where I live looks a lot like LA. So do that. Bring American actors over here.
Very cool. And, you know, mentioning Jackie Earle Haley is, I'm a Watchmen any type defender.
Oh, yeah.
So even Zack Snyder's version, I love as well. But I mean, I love all the Watchmen properties pretty much. I really like the TV show, but he's so good in that.
He's the coolest dude in the whole world as well.
Yeah, I know that's like not like he's done so many things. It's a weird reference to make, but I just do love Watchmen. He's so talented, obviously. So it's crazy that, I mean, you've worked with a lot of talented people.
I thought he was awesome as Freddy too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked that remake. I really did, which I didn't expect I would because I don't like a lot of them. But I was like, yeah, man, Freddy's just so fucking cool in this. So I really, he's such a cool guy as well. He's someone I would just totally jump to work with again.
Very cool. Just insight like you've given us has been super cool. And the behind the scenes stuff. And then I'm just super jealous of the talent that you've gotten to work with, both Australian and American. Because like I said, you've had some amazing performances, starting with Hounds of Love. That cast also was doing really cool things. And from my understanding, won some awards at some festivals as well for some of the cast members as well, not just the film itself, but not surprising there. With all your experience, we do want to pick your brain. For anyone who is aspiring to be a filmmaker, what would you say to them as advice? And the only rule is you can't say just do it, because let's say they've already decided to just do it. And now they're like, all right, so I'm going to do it.
Okay, right.
But what do I do, right? Like, how can I do it? So what would your advice be?
I think that there's two reasons why everybody becomes involved in the arts. And one is result and one is process. And process is walking the red carpet at the Cannes Film Festival or at the Academy Awards. No, result is walking the carpet at the Cannes Festival or the Academy Awards or something. And process is sitting at your laptop and staring at a blank screen and not knowing how to fill the page. If you don't fall in love with the process and you're only after the result, you're going to have a miserable life. Because even as a working filmmaker, the rejection, you still get 9 rejections for every yes you get. I have been attached to so many movies since Hounds of Love that have fallen over, like movies with huge cast and big budgets that I was literally packing my bag to go and it fell over. So you need to learn to love the entire process, which is, you know, meeting with actors and pitching and just writing alone in your house at 4 a.m. or standing in the freezing rain in white Georgia at 3 in the morning. And yeah, if you don't fall in love with the process, you can have a very, very miserable life. So learn to love it. And if you're in it for the result, I think you're not going to enjoy the process, because there's a great misconception through the media about what it means to be an actor or be a filmmaker. It is not glamorous at all. And it is not glamorous even at the top. Like Billy Bob Thornton was in freezing cold conditions with me in Georgia, having to walk through the mud over and over and over again at 3 a.m. And guess what? He did it, and he did it with a smile on his face. So that's because he loves the process, and that's why he's at the level that he is. And so does Robin, and so does everybody who's kind of up there. So I can't emphasize how hard it is, and how if you don't love or find a way to love the difficult part of it, you're never going to get there, because the difficult part is 90% of it. The other thing is, I won't say just do it, but I'll put a spin on it. I'll just tell a little anecdote, and that is, of all of the people I grew up with who ended up cracking it, and when I say cracking it, I mean making a proper movie with other people's money, you know, and all of that kind of stuff, and kind of being paid to do their craft, none of them were the best at what they did when we were at film school, but they were all the most persistent, myself included. Like when I finished at film school, I wasn't even deemed good enough to be allowed to make a film. So I didn't, but I just wanted it more than everybody else. And so I tried and I failed and I tried and I failed. And so the advice, I guess, is hurry up and fail, because your first thing is going to suck. And your second thing is going to suck, but maybe just not quite as much. And so hurry up and fail is really important, because I can't stress how much better you get after everything that you do. And so be prolific and embrace failure.
I think that was fantastic. I think failure is always the greatest teacher. I love that you gave that insight.
Yeah.
And I promise next question is going to be the wrap up. But one more thing I wanted to ask you, you were talking about the result and the process and loving the process. But I just wanted to ask you personally, what would you consider in your career to be like a moment where you felt like this is a big win, where you like let yourself really enjoy that result?
I think it was the premiere at the Venice Film Festival. I think that was really it, because I could tell that the audience dug the movie, despite, you know, a lot of people walking out. It was a huge theater that it played at, and there was movie stars in the audience, and I got there and thought, wow, we made this movie for under $2 million in the most isolated capital city in Australia with no movie stars. And here we are at the Venice Film Festival playing to a packed theater full of people I've grown up idolizing. That was a big win. But, you know, you have other little wins. I won't name drop, but I had a giant movie star see that movie and like me so much, she flew me to New York just to have lunch with her. That was kind of big win as well. Yeah, they're the cool things, but you can't hang on to them. I think a big reality check for me is, unfortunately, Venice, a lot of the cast couldn't get to. Emma got there, but Steve Curry couldn't, Ashley Cummings couldn't, Susie Porter couldn't. So that was, it would have been great if they could, but they couldn't. But all of them went to Tribeca, and I couldn't go to Tribeca because I was in Serbia shooting Extinction. And, you know, I had a little bit of a moment where I went, I want to be in Tribeca at the red carpet being celebrated. But it was then that I came up with that, you know, result versus process. It was like, no, Ben, you did not become a filmmaker to walk red carpets. You became a filmmaker so you could make more films. What a great fucking excuse to not be at Tribeca. You are making another movie. How cool is that? You know, so yeah.
I love that outlook.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
No worries.
Yeah, honestly, just we've said it already, but I want to thank you again for all the great insight you've given us.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Not only about, like we said, the process, but the behind the scenes stuff on movies that, like I said, Extinction is, Hounds of Love is a really good movie as well. I mean, they're both really good. Extinction was one that I had watched in the past, so it's like got like a nostalgic effect as well.
Oh, cool.
Hounds of Love is one that I've recently watched for the first time and then was like, oh, same guy directed Extinction. No way.
Oh, you didn't know. You just randomly watched it.
No, yeah, no. I found out that you had also done Extinction. I was like, well, that's one of my favorites, obviously. So it just.
Oh, thank you.
it's really cool to always get behind the scenes stuff and insight from someone, but like to also get it about a movie that you really had such an impact on you and stuff, and a filmmaker who's made two films now that have been really enjoyable for me to watch and like have been like a great experience watching.
Oh, thank you.
Like, it's even cooler when it has that kind of connection. So we really do appreciate it. I know our audience is going to love it as well.
Oh, no worries.
So with that, we have our final question and we will let you go. We ask all of our guests this one question, and it is, are there any other filmmakers that maybe our audience haven't heard of that you would like to recommend to us?
Yes, there are. Zach Hilditch, who is one of my best friends, and I went to film school with him, and he made his first movie about 2 years before I made Hounds of Love, and he was huge, huge help with me, like on giving me notes on the script and giving me advice, and he made a movie called These Final Hours, which is a sci-fi movie about literally the last final hours on Earth, and it's awesome, and it's set in Perth, and it had its premiere at Director's Fortnight in Cannes, and he's awesome. He made another movie for Netflix called 1922, and he made another Netflix movie called Rattlesnake as well. And this guy is he's my ride or die. He lives just down the road from me in Perth, the most isolated capital city in the world. And he has been a huge influence on me because he kind of proved to me that you can do it from this tiny isolated city with a population of like 2 million people. So yeah, and his films are pretty cool.
Again, small world stuff. It's very funny. Obviously, it's not that funny because I'm sure his films have been seen by a lot of people. But 1922, you mentioned that. I'm like, oh, definitely a film that I watched on Netflix, enjoyed a lot, and would love to hear more about him.
And another guy I went to film school with right here in Perth, who also lives in Perth, is a guy called Grant Spatore, who made I Am Mother.
There you go. Wow.
Yeah, and all three of us were at film school together in Perth, which is just crazy, huh?
Talk about a Duncan movie.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that one.
I Am Mother. It falls right into that category. And you can.
I thought you'd like that one, yeah.
Best believe I've seen that one. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is very much. It's got everything a Duncan movie needs to have, basically.
Yeah. So the three of us all live in Perth, and we all hang out all the time and get beers together, and yeah.
Well, thank you again. That last answer fell right in line with the great answers you've already given us, because I'm super excited to check out.
Thank you.
I mean, These Final Hours, it sounds like it's going to be right up my alley as well. And
I think that'll be a Duncan movie.
That sounds like a Duncan movie.
That's what it sounded like it, right? As you were saying it, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll be watching that one very soon.
Yep.
And if it's by the guy who made 1922, I haven't seen Rattlesnake, so I'll have to check that one out as well. But if it's by the same person who made 1922, I definitely believe that it's not going to be poorly done.
Yeah, it's very good.
The premise sounds good, and it's by a filmmaker who is definitely good at his craft, so I'm definitely excited for that. And if anyone listening hasn't checked those movies out, I definitely vouch for the ones I've seen, and I'm going to check out the other ones. And I know we did a spoiler warning at the beginning when we opened up this podcast so that you knew that you had to see Extinction before listening to this. But if you haven't, you spoiled it for yourself. You shouldn't have done that. And go check it out. But before we let you go, can you just remind our audience, obviously Extinction's on Netflix. We've said that Hounds of Love is available on Tubi, but VOD is probably better, so you get no ads. Unfortunately, as of now, you know, we'll update you guys if it does come available on streaming. But do you have like a website or any social media that you want people to follow you on, or just watch the movies?
Oh, well, watch the movies, and yeah, and jump on IMDb and give them a generous rating if you do, because that matters. And Extinction doesn't have a very high rating, and so yeah, you know, jump on there and give us a nice rating for it. But yes, you can find me on my Instagram handle is very simple, because I'm old and I got on there when no one was using the platform. It is just my name, at Ben J Young. So BenJYoung, which is just my name.
Perfect. So easy, simple. No one's going to get lost on that. And like I said, definitely if you haven't seen Extinction already, I don't know what you did to yourself, because it's definitely worth watching without really knowing too much about it going in. But hopefully you listened to my very explicit spoiler warning at the beginning, where I was adamant about you not listening without watching Extinction. But check out all of the future work as well. I know I'm super excited for everything coming out. Really cool that it's not just like one, so it'll be kind of a staggered drop. You know, hopefully it will be like, you'll get one every little bit of while as those come out. And we'll definitely be updating our audience as they do come out. And hopefully...
Oh, I'm wearing my Extinction crew gift right now.
Oh, awesome.
There you go.
See, this is, yeah, that's a perfect reason to get involved in filmmaking, is just to have all the cool merch behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm just joking. The process is what you have to fall in love with. We've mentioned that. But
yeah,
seriously, thank you for taking the time today. I know it's super early for you, and you not only took the time, but gave us really good answers during it. And we really do appreciate it. So thank you.
Thank you guys for asking such considered questions. It made it much more interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's what we try to do. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you. Yeah, have a good day.
Have a good day. Appreciate you.
Yeah, take care. Bye.
Bye.
There you have it, folks. That was our interview with Ben Young. A huge thank you to him for stopping by and for taking the time out of his day to talk to us and to also give us some really insightful answers and some stuff that I'm really excited to look forward to in the future. I know he teased some really cool projects. Keep your eyes out for that. We'll keep you guys updated on anything that comes out about that. Obviously, we have a little bit to wait for some of those, but a lot to get excited for. A lot of great answers on his past work as well. So if you ignored my spoiler warning, then you got some stuff spoiled. That stinks, but I don't know how you could listen to that and not want to go back and watch the movies we were just talking about. So definitely, we said that you didn't necessarily need to see Hounds of Love before this interview. So if you haven't seen that, definitely check it out after listening to those words. Super big thank you, Ben Young. That was great.
Seriously, Ben, if you're listening to this, thank you. To our listeners who made it to the end, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. And speaking for Duncan, I know he enjoyed it as well. Ben just gave really great insights on not only his creative process, which I think is always really valuable, but the industry strategies for each individual to go out and explore their creativity. And he was just super cool about talking with us. You know, we weren't sure how long we were going to go. He's a busy guy. He's got lots of projects moving around. And I mean, we had a really great conversation for over an hour. And that was super generous of him with his time. And I learned a lot. I hope you learned a lot as well. Hopefully one day we can get him back on. He might be too big for us by then, but hopefully not. Ben, again, thanks for coming on the show. To everybody, thanks for tuning in.
Yes. Again, thank you, Ben, for stopping by. Thank you for taking the time. Listeners, if you want to check out his work, we have the links in the description of the podcast. So check it out there if you haven't already. And you can check out his future work as well. But like we both said, thank you, Ben, for stopping by. Also, a little thank you to a past guest who our listeners will remember, Alex Lorien, for shouting Ben Young out during the end of his interview. If you guys remember that, we've actually got a sneak peek of Ben's work earlier on a past episode. So thank you to both of them. And like Gardner said, thank you to all of our listeners as well. We appreciate our new listeners as well as our recurring listeners. We thank you for sticking around to the end and hope that you liked it enough to listen to some more. Maybe you'll check out our back catalog of episodes. We got 80 plus episodes that have already been released, or just stay tuned for what we're dropping next week and in the future. Like I said, next Tuesday, we're going to be talking about Thor 4 in our MCU episodes. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about the entire season 3 of The Boys. On Friday, we'll have another interview for you, so stay tuned for that. Not going to tell you who it is yet, but it'll be fun. And then to look even further in the future, the week after that, we'll have a recap of the first season. I don't know if it's going to be the only season, but season 1 of Ms. Marvel on Disney Plus will be our Tuesday MCU episode, and you'll have to stick around to find out what comes out after that. As always, if you do want to follow along with all those new episodes and check out our back catalog of episodes, you can find us on all the podcasting platforms. Anywhere you listen to podcasts, we are available by searching the letters GDT. That's right, we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the free ones as well. And you can find us super easy. 3 letters, all you got to type in, GDT. You'll see our nice little logo. You can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And if you're feeling nice, you could also leave a nice 5-star review, which helps us out and makes us feel good and does nothing for you as well. So if you're worried about missing episodes even after you subscribe, then why don't you follow us on our social media platforms as well? You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at GoodDataPod and on Facebook at GDT Podcast. We post most of our episodes on those social media platforms, and you'll see some nice artwork to go along with them as well. So check those out. Show us some love on the social media platforms, and you'll never miss an episode if you do those things. Subscribe on any platform, GDT, and find us on social media. That is the end of the show. That was your interview with Ben Young. Huge thank you again. That wraps it up. Thank you, folks. We will talk to you again next week.
As always, folks, thank you for tuning in. We love you, and we'll see you on the next one.